Slahia with airstrikes and artillery. Eastern parts of Rafah city in the south were also targeted by the regime's tanks and helicopters. Gaza government media office has reported nearly 500 breaches of the US-brokered ceasefire in just 44 days. It has said these violations constitute a flagrant breach of international humanitarian law and the humanitarian protocol attached to the agreement. It stated that since the ceasefire came into effect, over 340 Palestinians have been killed in the regime's attacks, with children, women and the elderly making up the majority of the victims. In its latest strikes, Israel killed more than 20 Palestinians on Saturday. In the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime continues its strikes despite a ceasefire agreement, killing more Palestinians. Our correspondent Garda Ibrahim earlier joined us for more details.
The Israeli violations of the U.S.-brokered ceasefire agreement continue on the ground, and more attacks are taking place in all the parts of the Gaza Strip, from the south to the north. Since the dawn of this morning until now, we are talking about four martyrs were killed in direct attacks by the Israeli occupation forces. Two were killed in Khan Yunis city as a result of an airstrike that targeted them. Another attack was also on the eastern parts of Ash-Sha'af area in the eastern parts of At-Tufah neighborhood east of Gaza, and that resulted in one martyr. Another attack was also on Beit Lahia town, and that resulted in another martyr. Again, these attacks are continuous. More gunfire is heard from the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city since this morning. Many injuries were reported from Nasser Hospital as a result of a drone attack that opened fire towards a group of people on the eastern parts of Beni Sahela area in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis. Until this moment, we are still hearing the same and the continuous Israeli attacks and artillery shelling that are targeting the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah city, the eastern parts of Al-Bridge and Al-Maghazi refugee camp in the eastern parts of the Gaza Strip. Again, these attacks are continuous, happening every day since the beginning of this ceasefire until now. More attacks and demolishing operations are taking place on the eastern parts of Ash-Sha'af and Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhoods as Israeli occupation army, according to the locals in these areas, are expanding the area or the yellow zones in these areas since
Israeli forces and settlers press ahead with violent raids on Palestinian towns and villages across the occupied West Bank, causing more casualties and property damage. In one of the latest incidents, a young Palestinian man was killed during a raid on the village of Deir Jarir, east of Ramallah. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 20-year-old Bara Khairi Ali Mali was shot by Israeli soldiers live fire in the chest. Local sources reported that settlers stormed the village and assaulted residents and their homes, while Israeli forces provided protection for them. Since the start of the Gaza genocide, the Israeli forces and settlers have intensified their attacks across the West Bank, including the occupied city of Al-Quds. According to Palestinian sources, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed and over 10,000 others injured in the West Bank since the October of 2023. The Hezbollah resistance movement has confirmed the martyrdom of its senior commander Haitham Ali Tabatabai during a Sunday Israeli airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. In its statement, the movement said Tabatabai was martyred in Israel's treacherous strike on the Haret Horeik district in Beirut's southern suburbs. It described him as a committed commander whose sacrifice inspired the resistance with hope, resolve and strength in its battle against the enemy. Hezbollah stressed that following his martyrdom, resistance fighters will move forward with steadfastness and courage to defeat all projects of the Zionist enemy and its main supporter, the U.S. Israel's attack on Beirut killed at least 5 people and wounded 20 others. The strike marks another flagrant violation of the ceasefire agreement signed between the regime and Lebanon a year ago. Israel has carried out nearly daily attacks on southern Lebanon since then. However, this is the first time in months that Beirut has come under attack.
Israel has struck a residential building in the heart of the Beirut suburbs. The third and fourth floors of a 9-story building were badly damaged, with debris filling the road, damaging cars and property. Deputy head of Hezbollah Political Bureau confirmed that a senior commander was targeted in the strike.
This is an attempted assassination, targeting a key leader within the resistance. What matters now is that we document this as a clear act of aggression, an escalation we cannot and will not tolerate. It is our responsibility at the national level to establish a response that confronts Israel's attempt to undermine our sovereignty.
Although the Israeli statement said the target was a commander in the resistance, people near the scene say Israeli strikes are targeting everyone.
I am from this neighborhood. Every time they come up with this claim that they are targeting a member of the resistance, we are all members of the resistance. I want to tell our prime minister, who was a judge in the international court, if your diplomacy can't protect us and solve our crisis, then leave us to be and don't speak in our name. And this mechanism is obviously biased towards Israel.
Alice believes the Israeli claims that Hezbollah has rehabilitated is merely preparing the ground for a larger escalation and a U.S. green light for this aggression.
This marks a new level of violation, and there are two potential outcomes. Either the resistance retaliates, which would escalate into a full-scale war, or they absorb this blow, which could embolden Israel to carry out further strikes. Both options are devastating. This is a turning point. With Israel seeking to normalize its escalation in Lebanon, backed by U.S. support, and with the Lebanese government failing to take action.
President Joseph Aoun called on the international community to intervene firmly to stop Israeli attacks on the country. Lebanon, he said, reiterates its call to the international community to assume its responsibility and intervene firmly and seriously to stop the attacks on Lebanon and its people. The Israeli strike on the southern suburbs of Beirut and the U.S. blessing are considered part of the growing pressure by both sides to enforce full surrender by Hezbollah and full compliance of the Lebanese government to disarm the resistance. However, many believe that this opens the way for different scenarios, especially if the resistance decides it is time to retaliate. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israel's assassination of a top Hezbollah commander in Lebanon has sparked a strong wave of condemnations from regional countries and resistance movements. Iran's foreign ministry strongly condemned Israel's, quote, cowardly assassination of Haytham Aliatabatabai in an attack on a residential area of Beirut. The ministry said the strike was a savage assault on Lebanon's sovereignty and national integrity and a blatant violation of the country's ceasefire deal with Israel. It also slammed the inaction of the UN and its Security Council on Israel's frequent crimes against Lebanon, urging immediate international action to stop the regime's terrorism. Earlier, deputy head of Hezbollah's political council, Mahmoud Kamati, said the assassination will escalate violence across Lebanon. Lebanon's President Joseph Aoun called the strike a clear sign of Israel's disregard for repeated international appeals to halt its assaults. Hamas condemned the attack as a cowardly act of aggression aimed at dragging the region into a wider war, while Yemen's Ansarullah movement denounced the strike as a blatant violation of international humanitarian law. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad also slammed the attack as a war crime. On the National Day of Anonymous Martyrs, funeral processions have been held across Iran to honor 300 martyrs from the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. In Tehran, a large procession was held for 100 martyrs of the Sacred Defense. Coinciding with the martyrdom anniversary of Dame Fatima Zahra, nationwide funeral ceremonies were held for 300 martyrs of the 8-year war imposed by Iraq simultaneously in all 31 provinces. The participants paid tribute to the sacrifices made during the war, accompanying the martyrs to their final resting place. The remains will be buried in various locations, including universities, seminaries, and public parks. For more on this, I'm now joined by Gisu Misha Ahmadi, joining us from where this ceremony is taking place. Gisu, over to you.
We're at the Martyrs Memorial in the Iranian capital, Tehran. And like you mentioned yourself, funeral procession, similar processions actually, have been taking place in 31 provinces across the country and all the major cities. These unknown soldiers are being bid farewell. They will be taken to their final resting place. These are the unknown soldiers of the eight-year Iraqi imposed war. Their remains have been discovered. And now, as you can see, huge crowds in Tehran and millions across the country have been taking part in this funeral procession that began in the early hours this morning, 8 o'clock to be precise. This ceremony began in Tehran from Tehran University. The people that you see here have been walking about 3.5 kilometers to get here to Tehran's Martyrs Memorial. But this is more than a funeral procession for fallen soldiers, Bahman, for Iranian. This is, again, another opportunity to pledge allegiance with the values of the Islamic Revolution. And, of course, this is what post-revolution Iran means. This is what Iranians stand up for, defending their country, sacrificing their lives for their territorial integrity. And as you can see, people from all backgrounds are taking part in this funeral procession. You can see people young and old. Many of them are even martyrs' families, and many of them are those who sympathize with those families that have lost their loved ones in the eight-year Iraqi imposed war, and even those who don't even know where the remains of their loved ones are. So this is pretty much a symbolic procession, Bahman, and you have to read between the lines to understand how important this funeral procession is and what it signifies about Iranian culture and, of course, standing up for what's right and defending the homeland, Bahman.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the reporting. Gisum Shahmadi joining us from the where the procession of this funeral is on the way. Gunmen have attacked the headquarters of Pakistan's Federal Constabulary in Peshawar, killing at least 3 officers. The complex was struck by 2 bombers, with one detonating explosive at the main entrance and another entering the compound. The assault also left at least 6 civilians injured, who were rushed to local hospitals. Security forces, including army and police units, have cordoned off the area amid fears more attackers may be inside. The headquarters is located in a crowded district near a military camp. No group has claimed responsibility, although a group known as Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan has been blamed for similar attacks in the past. The surge in violence has further strained relations between Islamabad and Afghanistan's Taliban government, which Pakistan accuses of harboring militants since the 2021 takeover. Russia's defense ministry says its air defenses have intercepted and destroyed over 90 Ukrainian drones overnight. The drones were downed over 4 regions, including the border Belgorod region and over the Black Sea and the Azov Sea. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials reported a massive Russian drone assault on Kharkiv, killing 4 people and injuring 12 others. 15 strikes were recorded in 6 districts of this northeastern city. This comes as U.S. and Ukrainian delegations are engaged in intensive talks in Geneva on Washington's peace proposal. Both sides described the negotiations as highly productive, agreeing to revise the framework document. The initial 28-point proposal put forth by the United States last week calls on Ukraine to cede territory, accept limits on its military, and abandon its ambitions to join NATO. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators gathered outside a local synagogue in London to protest an event hosted by the World Zionist Organization. The event, titled Aliyah Day, was held to encourage Jewish immigration and settlement in the occupied Palestinian territories. A significant police presence was deployed to secure the area. Tensions rose as officers clashed with demonstrators, including a number of Jewish anti-Zionist protesters. We now listen to some of the voices from outside the synagogue.
We couldn't be more peaceful than we were today. We weren't even chanting. This is a protest organized by Jewish people. We were singing across the road, and we started being abused by the people on the other side, the Zionists. Suddenly the police comes, and as soon as we arrived, the police told us that there was Section 14 in place already.
We don't want to be protesting outside synagogues as Jews. That feels deeply wrong and uncomfortable, but we're also not going to stand by whilst our communities and our community spaces and our religious spaces and our leadership enable genocide, enable colonial occupation, encourage those in our communities, people that we grew up with, to participate in the colonial project that is Israel. So we've come together as Jewish Anti-Zionist Action and other Jewish groups in the Jewish bloc here in London, in collaboration with our friends from Power Pulse, to protest this event.
We are protesting against this, the Zionist people who sell the places in Israel for the settlers. It's against the Jewish religion to have our own state in exile. It's forbidden by God to steal land from other people.
And that is a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you so much for staying with us. It's goodbye from me, Bahman Roy.
Palestinians are terrorists because they use human shields, right?
Well, that's what the Zionists love to say when they justify bombing hospitals and schools. They routinely claim that Hamas houses command and control centers underneath hospitals, apartment buildings, and schools. Of course, all of that has been debunked and is a total lie. But what if I told you that the Israelis were projecting? Because we all know that their every accusation is a confession. Well, a groundbreaking report by the Gray Zone has just exposed a highly secretive IDF command and control center beneath a densely populated civilian area in North Tel Aviv. And the best part, Iran directly bombed it during the 12-day war with Israel back in June. On June 13th, Iran launched a barrage of missiles at Israel. The Zionists immediately began crying about how Iran was bombing civilians, not caring about the fact that they had been slaughtering civilians themselves in hospitals and schools in Gaza for 2 years. But as it turns out, Iran wasn't firing inaccurate missiles indiscriminately at Israeli civilians. They were actually targeting high-value military targets. In this clip here, you can see the Fox journalist Trey Yanks reporting the aftermath of the targeted site. He was immediately told to stop filming by Israeli police.
The Iranians have responded with three waves of ballistic missiles. This is Israel's version of the Pentagon, the Kiryat. And the building on this compound was just hit.
Please go back. Go back, please.
You can understand here, it's very tense at this location. Because the Iranians are now targeting the defense establishment of Israel. And so I'm going to have my cameraman pan up here to this building just across the street from the
Kiryat.
Moments prior, Iran had struck the north tower of the Da Vinci apartment complex roughly 550 meters southwest of Yink's location. The Gray Zone determined that the building sits immediately south of the Kinneret Israeli Air Force towers and above an underground military intelligence bunker jointly administered by the U.S. and Israeli militaries. According to an analysis of leaked emails, public documents, and Israeli news reports, the location is host to a highly secretive, electromagnetically shielded intelligence facility known as Site 81. Leaked emails from a former Israeli military chief of staff further indicate that Site 81 is an important command and control node. The Jerusalem Post also reported that an Iranian missile that struck the Da Vinci Towers was just a stone's throw from Netanyahu's office, which was then known as Building 22. The Prime Minister's office began undergoing renovations just weeks after the 2025 12-day war between Israel and Iran, and is rumored to have been damaged in the strike. Now, unfortunately, you can't use Google Maps to view the area because they have censored and blurred the information in order to protect secrecy. A photo of Site 81 published by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in February 2013 as part of a corrosion test of the underground structure's concrete overlay in galvanized steel plating can be geolocated to what is now the site of the Da Vinci apartment towers, with the southern of the two 18-story Israeli Air Force Kinneret towers just meters away. According to a website for the Kinneret towers, published by the Israeli construction firm Dan Yakibis, the buildings were constructed for the Israeli Air Force headquarters. The Israeli aluminum building enclosure company Alumeshet described its work on the towers in 2002 as including the construction of a blast mitigation system ensuring maximum security. But despite the sophisticated engineering, secrecy, and protection, Iran was still able to strike it and damage it. One Israeli resident of the tower complained that he was being used as a human shield. Quote, "Today I realize I've been paying 12,000 shekels or $3,650 a month to protect the Kirya," the resident explained, using the common shorthand for the Israeli military headquarters. The geolocation of the Site 81 photo suggests that the Da Vinci Towers are also protecting the secretive underground intelligence facility. The bunker is apparently located less than 100 meters from a children's playground, alongside a large community center which opened at the base of the towers in July 2023. By situating some of its most sensitive military installations in the heart of a civilian area, Israel has engaged in the human shielding practice it routinely accuses Palestinians of exploiting. A previously unreported leaked email exchange between ex-NATO commander James Stavridis and former Israeli military chief of staff Gabi Ashkenazi appears to confirm the presence of a command and control network operating inside the Site 81 bunker, smack in the middle of a densely populated civilian area. "Hi, Gabi," Stavridis wrote to Ashkenazi on September 1st, 2015. "I am working with an exciting company called Think Logical here in the USA. They build command and control networks and just won a big contract out at Site 81 with the IDF." Not only does this further expose Israel as the hypocritical genocidal state that it is, it also validates Iran's claims of having significantly damaged Israeli military infrastructure. Throughout the 12-day war, Israel bombed Iranian civilians, murdering hundreds of innocent people, including babies, while complaining about Iran supposedly indiscriminately bombing their civilians. Zionist propagandists also boasted about taking out Iran's more sophisticated missiles in their surprise attack, forcing them to rely on older, less accurate missiles incapable of precisely hitting their targets.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Spotlight. For decades, Europe was told it had a reliable partner across the Atlantic, a defender of a rules-based order. But now that promise lies broken and exposed as a lie. The so-called peace plan unveiled by Donald Trump is more than just a proposal to end the war in Ukraine. It is a stunning act of unilateral force, drafted in secret and presented to Europe as a finished deal they had no choice but to accept. Washington, in its arrogance, kept both Kiev and its European allies entirely in the dark on matters that directly threaten their very security. This is not diplomacy. It is a dictated peace. It is a plan that reads like a list of concessions to the Kremlin, demanding Ukraine surrender its sovereignty, its territory, and its future. And it comes with a threat. Sign or face the consequences. Tonight we ask, is this the end of the Atlantic Alliance? Has the United States under Trump become not a partner but a danger to European security? And how will Europe and a besieged Ukraine respond to this brutal new reality? But first, let's get more details in this report.
Ukraine's European allies are holding talks on the sideline of the G20 summit over Trump's proposed peace plan to end the Ukraine war. In a joint statement, they described the proposal as unilateral, saying that it requires additional work. They expressed concern over the proposed limitations on Ukraine's armed forces, saying it leaves the country vulnerable to future attacks.
The war can only end with Ukraine's unconditional consent. Wars cannot be ended by major powers over the heads of the countries involved. Rather, this is a war that can only end with Ukraine's consent and with our consent, the consent of the European Union, because it is a war on the European continent.
Kiev has also rejected key elements of the plan. The Ukrainian president's office said the country will never be an obstacle to peace, but emphasized that its representatives would continue to defend the legitimate interests of the Ukrainian people. President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history.
Now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. Now the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice. Either the loss of dignity, or the risk of losing a key partner. We did not betray Ukraine then, we will not do it now. And I know for sure that in this truly one of the most difficult moments in our history, I am not alone.
Neighboring Poland also expressed firm opposition, insisting that any peace agreement must be accepted by Kiev and that Ukrainians themselves must have a central role in negotiations. The White House has denied that Ukraine was sidelined, but skepticism in Europe remains high. Trump, meanwhile, has escalated pressure on Kiev, warning that Ukraine would lose additional territory in a short amount of time if it refused the plan, and declaring that Zelensky is going to have to approve it.
Well, he'll have to like it, and if he doesn't like it, then, you know, they should just keep fighting, I guess, you know.
The U.S. president said he had given Ukraine until Thursday to agree to the plan. According to widely leaked drafts, the U.S. plan includes several concessions Ukraine has previously ruled out. These include recognizing Crimea, Luhansk, and Donetsk as de facto Russian, obliging Ukraine to constitutionally renounce NATO membership, and reducing Ukraine's armed forces to 600,000 troops. Additional provisions would bar NATO troop deployments in Ukraine. The text also outlines steps for Russia's reintegration into the global economy and its return to the G8. For many European governments, the episode has exposed a far deeper worry. A peace plan drafted behind closed doors, unveiled as a near-final document, and built around sweeping concessions to Moscow, has intensified the sense that Washington under Trump is no longer behaving like a dependable ally. European officials say the administration bypassed NATO entirely, kept key European capitals in the dark about provisions that directly affect their own security, and excluded Ukraine, the country at the center of the war, from any meaningful role in shaping its terms. For Europe, the episode is a blunt reminder that under Trump, the United States is prepared to act unilaterally on matters central to Europe's security, even if its closest allies are left entirely out of the room.
Well, to analyze these new developments, we are joined by Mr. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Fredericton, Canada. And Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank both of you very much for joining us during this episode of Spotlight, of course. Mr. Bosnich, let's go ahead and start off with you, please. Let's start off with this U.S. unilateralism. Now, the Trump administration completely bypassed the NATO and the key European capitals in drafting this plan. Does this prove or at least signal that the transatlantic alliance is indeed finished?
Well, the transatlantic alliance, as we euphemistically call it, was never an alliance. It was an empire ruled from Washington with some advisors from London. And the rest of the countries across the mainland of Europe, were merely cannon fodder for an anticipated war against the Soviet Union. So this whole charade of a partnership, of an alliance, of America's partners not being satisfied that they weren't consulted, that is to use the initials, that is complete BS. There is nothing that the European so-called partners have ever been able to say to Washington. Washington has always been their controllers, and what's happening today with respect to Ukraine is an example of how Washington crushes opposing opinions among its federated military colonies. That's the straight story about what's happening.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and cross over to Mr. Stepling. Mr. Stepling, as we just now heard from Mr. Bosnich, I mean, basically the truth of what the U.S. is, what many people around the world know what the U.S. is, other than, of course, mainstream media, what they imply on what the U.S. is. This plan was presented, as we had mentioned, as a final document and, of course, not even as a starting point for negotiations. When it comes to the situation about Trump saying take it or leave it, what does this reveal about the U.S. and how it's using its power under Trump, or has this actually always been the situation with the U.S., or is it basically that Trump is just more clear about
Well, let's remember, firstly, that the U.S. began interfering in Russian elections all the way back in 1996. They made a Hollywood movie about it called Spinning Boris. Then there was 2014, the Maidan coup, completely orchestrated by the U.S., State Department, CIA. The U.S. has been meddling in all of this from the beginning. They kept moving NATO eastward. So this idea that somehow giving Donbass to Russia is an example of caving in to the dictator Putin, this is nonsense. Does everybody forget for 7 years Donbass was bombed? It's predominantly ethnically Russian, Russian-speaking, and they were bombed by Kiev. Terrorized by Kiev, people just seem to have this complete amnesia about this stuff. It's stunning. But the other thing is, we keep hearing in all of this, well, European security is threatened. Is somebody thinking that Russia is going to invade Norway or Spain or something anytime soon? Because they're not. They have no interest in trying to occupy a European country. I mean, this is farcical. It's pure fantasy. So yes, the U.S. acts unilaterally, but they always have. They just gave it a cosmetic treatment that made it appear democratic many times. But of course, NATO is run by the U.S. All policy decisions coming out of NATO have always been carried out by the U.S., carried out in Washington. So what we're seeing also, though, with European leadership, people like Jens Stoltenberg and Merz in Germany and Macron and the Finns and the Estonians, is this rabid Russophobia. And I always hearken back to the dismantling of Yugoslavia, because that was a lesson that people seemed to not have learned how that was carried out. That was the last nominally socialist state in Europe, and the U.S. had to see it crushed. The European leadership went along with that enthusiastically because there was money to be made. And so now we're seeing all of this saber-rattling from European leadership and from Brussels, von der Leyen, and Miss Callas, and they have no leverage. They rattle sabers that are made of paper mache. So it's the whole thing just strikes me as comical at this point.
Well, Mr. Stepling, I mean, as you're talking, I can definitely see Mr. Bosnich nodding and grinning in agreement, I believe. But Mr. Bosnich, I mean, you guys both mentioned the situation with the U.S., how history has basically shown. I do want to ask you, Mr. Bosnich, in relation to President Zelensky himself. Now, he spoke about this choice between losing dignity or losing a partner. Where does he fit on with all of this? I mean, the way that things have been playing specifically on media.
Well, first of all, this is whatever he says is what's being written for him by his CIA scriptwriters. the CIA organized through corrupt oligarchs in post-communist Ukraine. They organized the transfer of money to Ukraine to create Zelensky. So I appreciate the remarks of my fellow commentator today about people don't seem to learn lessons, or they don't at least remember lessons from the past, but you can't remember what you never learned. And the lying mainstream media, plus the totally dysfunctional educational system in the West, has hidden the fact that from the end of World War II, the United States and England especially have been active in Ukraine. In the 1940s and 50s, they recruited former Waffen-SS officers to run guerrilla operations in Ukraine. They then recruited many exiled Ukrainians and brought them into the State Department and planned these actions decades ago. My father was an acquaintance of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who went to university with him in Canada. He visited Zbigniew in 1978 in the White House when they discussed the upcoming plan for the disruption of Ukraine. And this was even before the Soviet Union collapsed. So there is nothing new under the sun, and certainly not in Ukraine. As for Zelensky, Zelensky is literally nothing other than a paid actor who was selected by his boss, the oligarch Kolomoisky, who has run off to Israel to hide, who worked for the CIA. And this is the final act of a very sorry and bloodthirsty tale written in Washington in the late 1940s as they looked at what resources they might have beyond the Iron Curtain, and they looked to former Nazis and they recruited them. And that's the explanation for why we've seen so many Ukrainian soldiers with SS and swastika tattoos burned into their bodies by their own choice. This reality is what is coming to the fore. And there's nobody in the EU who doesn't realize this. And all of their crocodile tears that they're crying now about, oh, Russia did this and America is telling us what to do, all of that is another example of acting by players who knew for years that this was coming up and that if they failed, they would have to disavow it. Nothing more. A PSYOP operated from Washington and running as a boat of death on the blood of Slavs, both Ukrainians and Russians, because it's a no-lose situation for Washington. If they can make the Ukrainian and Russian brothers hate each other for the next 20 or 30 years, they will have achieved one of their primary goals.
Well, Mr. Suppling, I mean, the plan, as we were mentioning, reportedly forces Ukraine to give up any hope of joining the NATO. Now, what would you tell viewers and people around the world that are saying, isn't this basically handing Putin his biggest victory on a silver platter, coincidentally being delivered by an American partner? Where is Putin in all of this, and Russia, of course?
Well, I mean, Russia won the war. This tends to be what happens when you win a war. But again, remember that this was a corrupt regime in Kiev before Zelensky that was bombing the Donbass, which is predominantly Russian. They talk about the illegal annexation of Crimea. There was, in fact, a referendum. But these points have long historic tales behind them. You can't really understand it unless, as John pointed out, you go back to World War II and the end of World War II. But beyond that, what Ukraine right now is primarily objecting to in this peace plan is not giving up territory, is not losing any hope of joining NATO. They were terrified about this audit that was going to happen because they obviously are corrupt and stole dozens of billions of dollars that they have no way of explaining the disappearance. And it went into the pockets of oligarchs and Zelensky's pals and into Zelensky's pocket. And the thing is, everybody knows this. I mean, we're seeing, Zelensky's not the only actor here. I mean, we see these performances from European leaders as if the Russian hordes are assembling at the gates to the European civilization, and they're about to break through and march down the Champs-Élysées or something. I mean, Russia has enough on its plate. It's going to be quite happy to just wrap this up and hopefully get some relief from sanctions and so forth. But they have no imperialist ambition whatsoever. I mean, this is just ludicrous. So John's right. This was Washington wanting to put a ribbon on it, get done with it. Russia won the war. It's over. It's been over for 8-10 months. There was, you know, it was a complete waste of life for the last 10 months. They have been Shanghaiing men off the street in Ukraine to use as cannon fodder, throwing them into this meat grinder. And you know, it's the typical story of war. The rich get richer. Defense contractors made a lot of money, so it was prolonged as long as it was possible, and now it's not possible. And as I say, Ukraine's biggest fear right now, the Zelensky administration's fear, is that they don't want an audit. The rest of it they don't care about. This was, you know, Crimea and Donbass was lost a long time ago. So this is, of course, written and scripted by Washington, because most everything in the world is these days. And this is no exception. I mean, I predict Zelensky will end up with a late night talk show in Miami. And that's probably where, you know, that was his past, and that's going to be his future.
And Mr. Bosnich, what do you have in regards to what Mr. Suppling said? Do you believe that the war in Russia-Ukraine is finally over and this is the ending?
Well, I'm actually more optimistic than he is. I think the war will continue. And the reason why I say that's optimistic is because I think that although Russia is prepared to have a peace agreement at this time, Zelensky is not. Because the people who pay Zelensky are telling him, listen, puppet, you're going to do what we say, or you are not going to be alive in a very short period of time. And so for Zelensky, it's a matter of life and death. And if he were ever to show up, as my fellow commentator says, in a talk show in Florida, it would be in the same cell as the Americans stuck their former collaborator Noriega, or wherever they stick any one of their tin pot puppet dictators once he's no longer useful to them. And the sad fact of this matter is that the Ukrainian people were deceived. Their lying mainstream media in Ukraine worked for a Hollywood script to create the servant of the people, who was no such thing. Zelensky was a servant of the CIA. That's the movie that needs to be made from his jail cell in Florida when he finally gets there, if he lives long enough to get there. This is a picture of the reality of the totally corrupt Anglo-American empire in play all the time, for not just the past, you know, 3 years of this war, but for the entire period, for the 11 years since the United States staged the fake coup d'etat in Kiev that brought to power the entire gang behind Zelensky. And I'm glad that the other commentator today mentioned Yugoslavia, because I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but I was an advisor to former President Milosevic when he was kidnapped and taken to The Hague. My family comes from Yugoslavia, and I was living until recently and will be returning to Serbia, the center of the former Yugoslavia. And what has happened in Ukraine is transparent to me and those of us who lived through the Yugoslav operation, because it's identical. They set up a fake group of puppets. Those puppets were corrupt and stole money. They were removed and replaced by other puppets, and you have the disaster zone that is known as Serbia today, with people marching for a year against a corrupt, totally criminal government. This is what always happens when you get crooks like the CIA and you dress them up in a suit and tie and pretend that they are statesmen. These are not statesmen. they are having no more success than putting lipstick on a pig.
Well, exactly, as you did mention, dressing up in suit and a tie, something we've seen in Syria and others recently, specifically. Mr. Steplin, we do have a few more minutes. I'd like to direct this question towards you. Under the Trump administration, under the U.S. specific last few years, I mean, the global system has been replaced. Has it been replaced in a system we now live in, which is basically a jungle, where only threats and force matter?
Well, let me try to answer that in a slightly circuitous way, but apropos of what John said, I was part of the committee to defend Milosevic, actually, and was in Serbia a couple of times during that period, and the U.S., as is always the case, was aligned with the fascists, the Croat fascists that go back to World War II. The people that constructed the Jasenovac concentration camp and so forth. The United States is never on the side of democracy. They weren't in Latin America or in Africa. They fought against African independence. They are always on the side of dictators because dictators are easier to control. Zelensky fits this to a T. But the idea that we're now in a jungle, we have always been in a jungle. I mean, this is Western imperialism, and the West is prone to coercive measures whenever they can. I mean, we look at the dying empire today, though, because the U.S. keeps threatening, for example, Venezuela, but they can't really invade Venezuela because their power has waned considerably. And the only thing that has changed with Trump is that he sort of has done away with the middleman, and he just cuts to the chase. But all these European leaders are flailing about, and they simply have no leverage. They have nothing to back up this. Macron was talking about the French are ready to go to Ukraine and fight. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's going to happen. I mean, I don't mean to laugh at this, but I don't know another response that makes sense. This is U.S. imperialism. It's as it has existed for 70 years, and it's no different. The end is, whether John is right or I am right about exactly how long Zelensky can stay alive and occupy his presidential suites, I don't know. He is beholden to the Azov Battalion people, the far-right fascists in Ukraine. They may want to take him out at a certain point. They clearly, those people are going to feel betrayed, certainly. But this was inevitable a year ago. This was inevitable. It was just going to be a matter of how and when and exactly what the terms of the so-called peace were going to look like. And they pretty much have ended up as most of us, I think, saw they were going to.
Well, on that point, I'd like to thank both of my guests, of course, for this very interesting discussion on this episode of Spotlight. From Fredericton, Canada, journalist, activist, and political analyst, Mr. John Bosnich. And, of course, as always, Mr. John Steplin, author and commentator. They're joining us from Indre, Norway. A pleasure to have you both. Until next time, goodbye. My eyes always waiting, whenever.
Destinies are written.
The month of no food and water.
We watch the weight of Islam tilt as demolished are its pillars. I watch the killer of Marhab and the conqueror of Khaybar struck on the head, and watching this reminds me of Ali al-Akbar.
A strike from which the heaven shook descends a book, a sensible.
Like Ali Akbar,
Ali Akbar, like him would look.